You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Isn't it beautiful out there?
Very sunny day.
It's a cracker.
Lovely weather. Summer, as you said earlier, seems to have finally begun, which is very nice. And we've got lots of science today, which is also great because it's one of the things I love talking about most on this Tuesday Wire. So what have we got to start us off? Self-experimentation.
And it's an interesting story this. So we're going to go biblical, which we don't often do on the Wire, and we're going to quote from the book of Luke.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
Physician, heal thyself.
It's a nice quote.
It is. And supposedly what it's meant to mean is that maybe you should sort yourself out before you go and try sorting everybody else out, sort of thing.
Perfectly applicable.
So how does this relate to our story? So we're going to talk about a lady by the name of Beata Hallise. So she is a 49-year-old virologist from the University. Ooh.
Sorry, that's my bad.
49-year-old virologist from the University of Zagreb in Croatia. And unfortunately, she was afflicted with breast cancer quite a few years ago, and that led to a mastectomy. So her left breast was removed.
Yep.
And you'd hope that that would normally be the end of it, but sadly it wasn't. And so she had two recurrences at the same site where she had the mastectomy.
Wow.
So the first reoccurrence, she undertook chemo.
Yep.
Sadly, didn't work. It came back, and she really couldn't face the whole chemo thing a second time.
I mean, that makes sense, right?
Sadly, it does.
Yeah.
Now, I said that she was a virologist, and that is very germane to the story.
Yeah, what is a virologist?
A virologist, somebody who studies viruses.
Ah, yes, that makes sense.
Okay. Now, so what she did was, she thought about how the heck she could possibly help herself with this, nasty situation that she was in. And so she hit the literature and she found this thing called oncolytic virotherapy, which is a great name.
Sounds incredible. What is oncolytic virotherapy?
Okay, so the basis behind this is that, we've got this immune system that does great at, getting rid of most nasties that get in. Doesn't really do it for cancer, not necessarily.
Okay? No.
But what happens if you take those cancer cells and you get a virus into those cancer cells that the body does recognize and that the immune system can then go and deal with?
It's like piggybacking, sort of putting a target on them.
It's a Trojan horse sort of thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely it is. And so that is a thing, this oncolytic virotherapy. Now, there's only one oncolytic virotherapy treatment that has been approved, and that is for metastatic melanoma. So there's nothing for breast cancer or anything like that.
Right.
And this is sort of late stage stuff as well. So we're talking sort of, the last resort type of thing here.
Right.
So she, at that time, she had stage 3 cancer. This was 2020. And as a result of her efforts, she's now been cancer free for the last 4 years.
Wow.
And so what did she do? So she, as I said, she, figured all this out and said, right, I'm an expert in virology, so I know what viruses I can get.
Perfect person for the job.
To put into these cancerous cells that are in my tumor.
Yep.
Okay. And she knew what type of cells were in her tumor, because she works in, this sort of place where they do this sort of stuff. And so what she did, she then came upon two viruses that would possibly be useful in this. So she used a measles virus, number one, and a thing called a vesicular stomatitis virus, which, funnily enough, is an animal virus, but it can be transferred to humans.
Sounds quite scary.
It does, but in fact they're not. So the thing that why she chose both of these was that they are both known to infect the types of cells from which her tumour originated. Okay, right. So they were specific to those tumour cells, So once they get infected, then the theory is, right, the immune system will get a signal, say, oh, we've got nasties in here, and they'll start going destroying those cells that have got the viruses in them.
And then those are the cancer cells.
And that's the theory, okay? And yes, you're going to inject yourself with viruses, but both of these viruses are relatively, relatively benign, okay? Sort of like a bad case of the flu sort of thing.
Right.
Okay? So what she did was, over 2 months, she got a colleague to inject these viruses directly into the tumour.
Yep.
Okay. And what they found was that the tumour shrank, which was fabulous.
Yeah.
Okay.
Seems perfect results, right?
And even better was that it detached from the muscle in the skin that it was sort of bound to. That's sort of a problem with a lot of tumours, is that you try and sort of surgically excise them, then they sort of gripping onto bits and everything, and that they're hard to get the lot of them, okay? But this thing basically shrank, it detached, and it could be removed surgically.
I mean, it sounds like she did exactly the perfect job.
Doesn't it? And so they got the tumour out, and then there was a one-year treatment with an anti-cancer drug, okay, just to make sure.
Hmm.
And as I said, you know, as a result of this, she's been cancer-free for 4 years. Now, the important thing is, when they took the tumour out, they analysed the tumour, and the question was, right, had it been attacked by the immune system? You know, were there fingerprints there that said, yep, the immune system's been doing its job? And absolutely, absolutely there were, you know. So that showed that everything worked, you know, perfectly.
Yeah.
And that the immune system was activated to hit the tumour and, you know, basically destroy it.
Mm.
Now, here's where the interesting... Well, here's another interesting bit here. She wanted to publish the results.
That makes sense. It seems like a huge breakthrough, right?
It does seem like a huge breakthrough. Absolutely it does. Except for the fact that it was... The paper that she wrote was rejected by over a dozen journals.
Why would that be?
Well, it all comes down to good old ethics.
Right.
Okay. And the ethics of self-experimentation.
Are we allowed to self-experiment? That seems logical, well, right?
There's your ethical question for you. Any ethics students that are listening, you know, that's the problem. Is it ethical to self-experiment? Could this possibly encourage other people to not take the normal treatment regime and actually sort of start experimenting on themselves?
Right.
That could lead to a can of worms.
The ethical consequences are less can you consent to self-experimentation and rather creating a dangerous precedent?
Yeah, that makes
sense.
Exactly. So, and to tell you the truth, I'm still not sure whether it's actually been published or not. I couldn't see whether the paper had been published or not.
Yeah.
But certainly this has made news.
Mm.
And, you know, it's absolutely worked.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about the ethics of self-experimentation. And previously on Dear Science, I can't remember when, it might have been a year or two ago, we talked about a guy by the name of Werner Forssmann, who in the 1920s, it was either the 20s or the 30s, he was the first person to put a catheter into his own heart. And there's your ultimate in self-experimentation.
That's a huge step.
So, you know,
either in the
arm or in the groin or something like that, and you feed the catheter through, push.
Terrifying.
And, you know, he did this all on his own.
Yeah.
And he wasn't treating himself or anything. He was just trying to show that it could actually be done.
I mean, crazy move.
Which it absolutely could.
Yeah.
And because of that self-experimentation, we've now got balloon angioplasty.
Yeah, wow.
Where you can, you know, stick a balloon in your heart and you can dilate those, you know.
So even if it doesn't get published, we've still got, you know, it's probably going to have good consequences for medical treatment of cancer.
Yeah, I mean, I think given the publicity, I can't see how it can't be published now, I think.
That makes sense.
You know, with certain caveats and everything like that. But, I mean, this is, you know, this is a remarkable story. Now, obviously, you know, she was just the right person in the right place at the right time because she had the experience.
Don't actually try this at home.
Yes, that's it. You know, if a certain person goes and tells you to use bleach for, you know, COVID, you're not going to do that, are you?
But here, just a virologist.
Here is somebody who's actually got the training to recognize that, yes, this could help me. And, you know, this could literally save my life.
Wow.
So I think, you know, I think this is a great story. And, yeah, let's see what happens in the future
about this. And so, then onto a slightly more whimsical and silly tone, these monkeys and typewriters, what are they doing? Are they typing?
Whimsical and silly, we never have that on Dear Science.
It's very serious. Yes.
Right, the infinite monkey theorem.
Yes.
And so supposedly if you give an infinite amount of monkeys an infinite amount of time, they could, and an obviously infinite number of typewriters, computers or word processors, whatever you want to say, they could come up with the works of Shakespeare.
They could write everything.
They could. And so this has been around for quite some time.
Yeah, sure, that's why it's typewriters and not iPads or whatever.
Absolutely. So a couple of Australian mathematicians sort of thought, well, you know, is this actually true? And what they wanted to do was to sort of look at this problem but make it a little bit more realistic.
Yes.
Okay? Let's not use the infinite thing because, you know, anything infinite...
I can't get infinite monkeys.
It's going to happen anyway. Yes. And you can't get infinite monkeys. But what you can get are the number of monkeys that are on the Earth at the moment. And in terms of time, well, let's say it's going to be the time of the universe.
Okay? Right. All of the universe.
Yeah.
Just until it goes.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
that's
basically
a fairly long amount of time.
So what they're doing, they're imposing limitations. So they're going to say, right, instead of the infinite time, we're going to have the age of the universe, which is estimated to be around about 10 to the power of 100 years, which is just a phenomenally big number.
Yes.
Anyway, just you know, totally beyond comprehension. And they're going to say, right, so we've got monkeys. How many of them? Well, the world population of chimpanzees, they chose chimpanzees, around about 200,000.
Okay, can they do it?
So there's a real sort of...
There's some time crunch here, there's some pressure.
We've got 200,000 chimpanzees. They're going to be typing at about one character per second.
Yes.
Okay.
Will the monkeys make it in time?
Over 10 to the power of 100 years. So their calculations, they reckon that there's a 5% chance, given these conditions, there's a 5% chance that one of the monkeys will type the word bananas.
Wow. That's pretty low. A 5% chance. That seems cosmically low.
And now when you think about it, so that's one word, okay?
Wow,
bananas,
yeah.
Okay. So Shakespeare, and somebody's counted this, somebody's counted this, 884,647 words in Shakespeare, apparently.
A lot of words. A lot more than one.
And so you would imagine that in terms of writing all of those words, there's going to be no chance. And you've got to get them in the right order as well.
Yes, right. You they know, could
you
write...
get all the right words, but they're completely out of order. And so basically the result of all of this is that they're saying that, you're not going to get that. And there's a lovely quote in the paper, slightly tongue-in-cheek. They say, it is not plausible that, even with improved typing speeds or an increase in chimpanzee populations, monkey labour will ever be a viable tool for developing non-trivial written works.
Yeah, so anyone thinking, you know, maybe I can get my monkeys to write Shakespeare, not in the cards for you.
Yes. No.
Might be looking at other animals, pigeons... Yeah, rabbits.
Could be.
Yeah. We haven't done any research there yet.
But so that's the infinite monkey theorem with boundaries, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
Is what we're saying.
I did speak on it earlier. I was slightly annoyed when seeing it in the news pop up, because obviously finite monkeys will not write everything. But it sounds more reasonable now that I've heard it fully explained.
Yeah.
And then lastly here, votes for Charles Darwin.
Yes.
Why are we voting for... He's not around.
Well, I was looking to a slightly bright side to what happened last Wednesday here.
Ah, yes.
And I couldn't find one, really.
Mm.
There's nothing to be joyous about there. So looking back on US elections, the 2012 US election was interesting for the participation of one Paul Brown.
Paul Brown.
And that's B-R-O-U-N.
B-R-O-U-N. Oh, interesting way to spell Brown.
I know. And he is from Georgia. He's a physician. He's into general medicine. And so as you do, he stood for Congress.
Yep.
And he stood for Congress unsuccessfully three times. And then in 2007, they had a special election, and he got in the special election.
Miraculous.
And he got re-elected in 2008 and 2010.
How did he do it?
And he was up for re-election in 2012.
Yes.
Again.
Okay.
Now, there was a bit of controversy because, okay, this was a guy that was on the House Science Committee. mm-hmm. okay, because he's a physician.
Yeah, so that makes
therefore,
sense.
Therefore, he yep. should know the ways of science.
Yes.
Okay.
Certainly.
Now, there was a leaked video of a speech that he gave at a church gathering, and what he said, something, quote, evolution, embryology, and the Big Bang Theory are all lies straight from the pit of hell.
Right. Not something you'd want your science advisors to be saying.
No, it's not. And so this got a few people's backs up, so particularly one local talk show host on the radio over there, and also a few University of Georgia professors
understandably
got on yep. the bandwagon, and they said, well, you know, we can't have this.
He's representing them as well.
He's going to win by a mile, unfortunately.
Mm.
But what we're going to do is we're going to encourage people to write in votes for Charles Darwin.
Ah, it's a bit of a protest. I see. They're saying evolution exists. I'm going to vote for Charles Darwin.
Yes. And so, of course, he won by a landslide.
Yes.
Did this Paul Brown. But in the county where the University of Georgia is...
How close was Charles Darwin?
Well, Charles Darwin got around about 4,000 write-in votes in that county compared to 19,680.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I know.
4,000 votes for... I mean, he wasn't even there. That's incredible.
So, yeah, at least somebody had a bit of a yes.
Voting
a whimsical sort of.
Wow, well, we did finish on a whimsical note there.
We did.
Slightly more whimsical than was anticipated for Dear Science. All right, well, thank you, as always, for coming in and sharing these glorious bits of science news with us, Alan. Thank you, Mosette, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.